Hello, and welcome to the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm Jeffrey Zeldman. Today's show is brought to you by An Event Apart, the design conference for people who make websites. Big Web Show listeners save $100 off any 2 or 3 day An Event Apart event in 2014 when you register using discount code AEABWS. That's AEABWS for An Event Apart Big Web Show to save $100 on any 2 or 3 day An Event Apart event. More information at aneventapart.com. And today's guest is Anil Dash, a hugely influential entrepreneur, blogger, and web geek living in New York City. Hi, Anil.
Hello, sir.
I'm amazed that we haven't had you on before. I feel like we, as we were saying just before the show started, I feel like we shadow each other in some strange way.
Yeah, we lurk in the same neighborhoods and we sort of occupy physically very close proximity to one another, considering how infrequently we actually speak.
Considering how infrequently we actually speak, it's strange and wonderful to me that I've gone to coffee houses because you go to them. It's like, oh,
yeah,
that sounds good.
Because I think our kids play in the same park, and we were sort of battling for the Foursquare mayorship of it.
I think, they play in the same playground, but at different times.
But never at the same time, right? Yeah, so it's just very interesting.
They get out different times of day.
I haven't seen the movie The Notebook, but my understanding is it works the same way. You're both in the same place, but like 100 years apart or something, and you write each other letters, and then we discover that we were soulmates.
It's a bromance.
Right.
Even though we would never use that word.
No. All mance, no bro.
All mance, no bro. That's interesting. I remember the first time we met. I don't know if you do.
I know it had to be at South by Southwest because this is the context in which all things are possible. South by Southwest the year before whoever is listening started going. But
exactly.
But I'm sort of I have to confess I don't remember the specifics of it, and I'm going to be chagrined when you tell me.
I think you had just started working for the White Stripes.
For Benjamina Trott, who had made Movable Type at the time, yeah.
Right. You were working for them, and I wasn't using any content management software to blog at the time because that was just a new world to me. I'd already been blogging for 10 years, and I was perfectly happy to type into my little HTML editor every day. I thought that's just what you did. So
sure.
You were
in HomeSite or BB Edit or something.
Yeah. I was actually in Page Spinner.
Oh my. Oh dear. That's
I was in Page Spinner.
I've aged visibly by hearing that name mentioned.
Really? You remember that?
I do. We are a similar vintage, sir.
Yeah, it was cool. I actually think Page Spinner had the best typography of any HTML editor at the time.
All because right. I'll concede that.
It separated the content. Right? The content was in any font that you wanted. So you could have large blue, I don't know, Times or Georgia or something content, and then monospaced different color code. And that was a bit to separate the code from the content was kind of an important thing to me.
So, sure, but it's you don't have to justify this. It's been a dozen years. I think we can all move on. I think your choice of text editor is always valid, but never more so than when a decade has passed.
I like that too. You're a philosopher. I remember finding it very hard to give it up. But anyway, so before I did, and now of course I use WordPress on my site, and I use we've used a million things on client work, of course, but at the time this was still very early days, and Six Apart were really pioneering this, right?
Yeah, it was an interesting time, and I think there was the sort of
I think it was the year 2000.
Yeah, it was. Well, Movable Type came out in 2001.
Okay,
that and that sort of I first went to South by in March of 2001, and then the app came out that fall. It was actually, I think, originally supposed to come out on September 11th.
Wow,
that was my recollection of it, and they delayed it by a month. It ended up coming out in October, and then that next spring.
So 2002 is when we met.
Yeah, that must have been when we
February sort of March of 2002 in mm-hmm. Austin.
Yeah, and so literally a dozen years.
I may remember this completely wrong.
It sounds plausible.
Bear with me. No. Okay. What I'm about to tell you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I had never met you.
Mm-hmm.
You tapped me on the shoulder. I turned around and you said, "Hi, this is Ben and Mina Trott, and they want to know why you hate them."
That sounds like something I would do. It's not entirely out of character.
And I didn't know who they were.
Sure, right.
I didn't know what they had done.
If I had to guess, what probably would happened is they had made movable type. They wanted you to use it. They had, knowing them then, been too timid to actually email you about it. Somebody probably did so on their behalf because what is an interesting thing about that time in the web is you had evangelical users. And obviously WordPress, I think, sort of was the apotheosis of this.
Right.
But you had people saying, go use this tool. And probably you had said entirely reasonably, "No, I think what I got is good. This has been working for me for 10 years.
I'm not even sure if that happened or I didn't see the email.
Sure, right.
Something.
Either way, something eminently reasonable where you either politely declined and or never heard about it in the first place. And they're sort of typical because they were, had not really been in these social circumstances was, "Oh, well, this person must hate us if they don't want to use this."
They were young and fragile.
Is that right? I mean, keep in mind, they were, 21 or something.
They were brilliant. And I mean, they still are, of course, but they were young and brilliant.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think I was probably teasing them for their sort of, lack of willingness to go up to you and say, "Hey, we made an app and we think you might want to check it out," and whatever, by exaggerating their insecurity that the only reason somebody might not use software that any of us make is because venom.
That's weird.
Pure venomous addict.
I have to deal with that myself a lot, and I've seen other people have a really hard time with that. My dad taught me this when I was young, but it didn't really stick for a while. He said, because he had that problem. Mm-hmm. He had someone he worked for take him aside and say, "Zeldman, you think if someone doesn't like become your best friend immediately, they hate you, but mm-hmm. probably they're just busy and indifferent."
Yeah. Well, and I think it was also easy to amplify that at that moment, in 2001 or 2002, because there wasn't the constant noise. I think it's almost impossible for somebody who's come up in the web in the last decade to realize, but the number of announcements on pick your site, TechCrunch or on Swiss Miss or whatever, in a given day of here's a new project, here's something to check out. I was looking at that site Product Hunt, which I think is very nice. And, here's
Product Hunt?
Hunt.
Product Hunt.
And it's just a sort of list of here's things today that you should check out that are apps. The number of apps that are on the homepage of one of those sites in a given day is how many apps we would have discovered in 6 months or a year.
Or a year, yeah. Totally right? Agree.
And so it was momentous when two folks in a spare bedroom, in a garage, in a dorm room, whatever, had built something. And so it wasn't entirely, it wasn't hubris or entirely unreasonable to expect, "Did you see my app?" as a conversation within the blogosphere or to have an opinion on it. Right now, it's sort of, I could be out there thumping my chest and jumping up and down and, "Hey, we built something and I'm really proud of it." And I wouldn't even assume that close friends have had a chance to check it out because of the sheer volume.
I used to, with similar arrogance, perhaps. If I wrote something at Zeldman.com, I reckoned that most people, at first I didn't, but after a while I became used to the idea that anyone interested in design on the web or front end design or development would be reading what I'd written.
Yeah. And to be fair, that was largely true for years.
And now I assume that nobody, even my best friend, reads it. It's really, and I don't expect them to, and my feelings
it's
aren't
probably
hurt,
better but, for yeah. my ego now that I know that they haven't.
You still read a lot. You are read and quoted a lot. And I'm you've managed to, in spite of everything else that you're connected to, blog frequently and meaningfully and hold people's attention for now, 15, 20 years. I don't know how you've done that, but maybe you have some insights to share with other bloggers who are struggling a bit to get an audience or...
Yeah, I find your premise flattering. I'm not sure I concur with it, but I like the idea of it.
I will like say this. Idea. If I talk to smart people that I know that are in this business, I'm not saying that you're the Huffington Post.
No.
And I'm not...
And thank you for that.
No, okay, but there are certain things like you're not a viral video or something. You're not something like everyone saw and passed around in the office. But smart people who pay attention to the future of digital technology. You know, if I'm talking to Karen McGrain or Paul Ford, just to pull two names out of a hat, I'm pretty sure that they've read everything that you've written recently, because you do.
Yeah, you know, that is it's interesting. I think so. I've been vlogging for 15 years. First, I should mention, you were extraordinarily kind to me right almost from the beginning. Very generous in linking to what I was doing and responding in the times when I did. And you, as such an elder statesman, even from the early days, that was incredibly motivating and validating. And I probably have never properly publicly thanked you for that. And I appreciate it very much.
You certainly don't have to. When I link to something, it's because I'm turned on and I want to share it with people. This is, I mean, when I interview people on the show, it's because I think this person's amazing, and I would hope that more people are paying attention to them. And for those who already are, hear some depth on that person, perhaps, and or some side of them you didn't know. And for those who weren't listening or weren't reading or weren't watching or engaging with their app, here's why, you know, maybe here's why you should. I just did it because I thought it was cool.
No, and I appreciate that. And I think we all cringe looking back far enough and what we've done to say, oh gosh, that was, I would do a better job of that today. But I don't want to understate, there was a very strong, whether perception or reality, sense that there was an A-list of bloggers and they were.
I remember that.
And that you know, you and a whoever Kocky, you want to name, a Jason Kocky and a Cam Barrett or whomever, Ev Williams, were gatekeepers as we perceived, because we did not have this idea that we were, that you had an unmediated voice. And so the assumption was, at least for me as an outsider, that it was akin to an editor has to approve a work to approve in a magazine, to appear in a magazine, and an A-lister has to.
That's,
sort of an anoint your content.
It's that's not sad. That's because that's really the opposite. The whole thing that was such.
Well, sure. You know, I tried to undo that too, and that's become less true in some ways.
But less true.
But that was the perception about, for lack of a better word, the class system within the early blogosphere.
It's weird. I think it was just when you started. If you started early, you were an elder statesman, regardless of how, the quality of what you were doing.
And that's also, true. And I mean, you know, I've said this a million times at different talks and in different conversations, but you know, when I started, there were, you know, 50, maybe 75 blogs, and I thought, oh hell, I'm late. Everything's been covered.
You could say you are introduced as a pioneering blogger, and
right,
it's not hyperbole.
Right. Yeah, I showed up late and still got to be early because the other 50 or 75 million showed up.
Right. And the people who were doing it at the very beginning, I mean, some of them are selling bicycles now.
Yeah, it's interesting that bifurcation. I mean, I've been reflecting on that a lot. I think South by is always a reflective moment for those of us that were of that context. But particularly this year.
Did you go this year?
You
went to a South by education or something? It was like a separate – what was that?
So I think they started last year, and I have to confess, I haven't kept up to date on everything they do. But I think last year they started South by EDU for people in education space and related areas. And this year I went. I've been part of an Aspen Institute task force on learning and technology. That's basically looking at how is learning going to evolve through the use of technology.
Now is that a client of yours?
No. This is a sort of a public policy effort where they just sort of assembled a round table of, you know, 30 of us. And I think my place in the room was to be the only person there that didn't have a college education.
You don't? No.
That's remarkable. I'm the first. We had the introductions and you had somebody with a PhD of this and a master's of that and, you know, multiple doctorates in this topic. And I said, I'm the first in my family not to go to college, much to my parents' great chagrin. Yes. And they sort of blinked at me and said, but I'm pretty good with computers. You know, I didn't, like, I had no credential of the conventional sort, but that actually is how all of education is evolving. So that was, I thought, task appropriate. But at any rate, all these other brilliant people, and hopefully a little bit of contribution from me, have been building this.
This is the Data and Society Research Institute?
Or? This is a totally separate thing. I can give you a list of all these crazy things I'm involved in that are inscrutable on the outside.
You donate a tremendous amount of time.
That's the main thing I try to do, is to spend a lot of time on what in my mind are categorized as civic effort.
But you have a wife and son. I don't know mm-hmm. if Elena works, but
yeah.
But mm-hmm. so what? Oh, yeah, what pays the bills? But besides,
maybe does it make sense for me to talk about how I see what I do, and then I can sort of fit everything into that?
Absolutely.
So my most conventional career is I'm the CEO and co-founder, along with Gina Trapani, of ThinkUp, which is a new app that we're building, and we can talk about that in a bit. I am also co-founder of a consulting firm called Activate that I started with Michael Wolff about 4 years ago, that does strategy for most of the biggest media and tech companies.
How
did I meet Michael Wolff?
I wasn't going to say that, although that's a good story too, but how do you get most of the big media and tech companies to pay attention and go, yeah, this is the person that knows what we should be doing? Because there's only a few people, a few consultants in that space that I know of that are actually making headway. So there's a lot of old.
Yeah. What I started doing, I'd lived out in San Francisco while we were building Movable Type and all that other stuff. And I'd come to the conclusion that I was sort of done with the technology industry as it was, you know, being a startup in sort of San Francisco in 2007 or whatever. And decided to come back home to New York. And the decision I made was I wanted to understand how big institutions work and how I could have impact upon them. And the conclusions I came to is that the culture and society overall are sort of shaped by really, and this is oversimplification, but by three broad institutions. One is the technology industry, to which I had great privileged access. The second was media and entertainment broadly, which I had some familiarity with. And the third was the world of policy and governance, which I at that time knew nothing about. And I say policy and governance distinct from politics and campaigning, which right. I had then and still have no interest in.
Right.
And so this idea was essentially government, media, and tech. These three forces shape where the culture goes and society goes, and they interact in interesting ways. I totally knew, or at least felt like I knew, how tech institutions form and happen and shape and grow, because I'd seen, you know, watching Matt build WordPress or watching Ev build Twitter or watching, you know, all these folks build these things.
Worked at those companies, or you just hung out with those guys as they were doing what they did?
No, just watching, just being friends and sort of, you know, occasionally informally consulting, right? You know, you go out for drinks and somebody talks about here's what we're struggling with, and you start to understand right. how the institution forms. And then in media, you know, being an arms dealer selling content management systems, you learned a lot about the dysfunction of the institution. I think in the same way that designers do when they go in and are you know, initially people approach thinking they have a superficial issue, and then when they start to understand that design is the way they think it works, they start to understand, well, we have to change the way our institution functions in order to properly implement a great designer's design. And that taught me how those organizations worked to some degree. I'd also been in the music business for a while and obviously been a big fan all my life. And so
Were you doing in the music business? I would imagine this was after high school or during high school.
This was actually, no, this was when I first moved to New York City in 1987 from rural Pennsylvania, where I grew up in the dark red heart of the state. I came to New York City the summer I was 21. I didn't know anybody. I was broke. I didn't have any friends. I learned how to get around the city using sidewalk.com. And I applied for a job at a place that was doing what today would be called online music promo. I had the sort of they eventually got aspirations of being a .com, and they had this sort of lofty view that they were going to be, I think today what we think of as a Vivo, right? Like a whole bunch of music videos online.
One way that you got smart is by sitting in lots of meetings where there was one or two smart people and then a bunch of dumb people and figuring out which was which.
That summer that first summer I had that job, I remember being in a meeting with a big record label in a big office building. I put on the closest thing to a suit that I had. Sat there. This is
where were you living?
I was living in Manhattan. I had an illegal sublet of a place. It was $550 a month for a one bedroom. Incredible wow. deal.
Was it a walk up?
It was a fifth floor walk up. Yep. I was in great shape. Briefly.
My brother had one of those too.
And in fact, it had very few vermin problems, except that reliably, if I had any women come over, immediately water bugs would appear, giant cockroaches. But only when there were women over. So that was
like
super handy.
Joe's apartment. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It was. I had Joe's apartment. That's where I lived during my brief tenure in the music industry. And so I was doing this gig, and I remember summer of 99 going to this meeting, big deal. This is my first time meeting really a senior executive in any company ever, like a billion-dollar company or whatever. And I sat there and sat through the whole thing, and there were some good ideas, some bad ideas, whatever. And at the end, I was like, you know, and I was the youngest in the room by years, and just kind of like, you know, almost literally raised my hand and said, hey, you know, what are you guys doing about Napster? This is to a big executive, senior executive at a big music label. And he said, what's Napster?
Oh, boy.
And I thought, either I am totally crazy or this guy is. We can't both be right. Like, we're both not living in the same world. And that was a kind of a transformative moment in my entire career was, oh, those of us that know how the bits and bytes work, that know how to install an app on our laptops, are actually going to see where the world goes even more than the people at the top with all the money and all the resources that they have. I was facing Eastbound. I can tell you exactly, I could tell you the address. Like, I know exactly where I was at that moment of sort of epiphany. And everything since then, that was sort of inflection point number one. Inflection point number two was when we saw blogs take off and the software got easier, and we knew, and I knew, oh, there's going to be 100 million of these. Everybody's going to do this every day. And to be clear, everything we do on Twitter and Facebook and Tumblr is a subset of how we thought blogging would evolve. So it's the reason I say everybody blogs every day is because we do.
And the weird thing is, I thought it too in 1995, but I couldn't see where the technology was going. I just thought everyone would learn HTML because at the time that was easy.
Yeah, for sure.
And I just thought, I couldn't even see that someone would make that people would make platforms.
No, I agree. I think, and you know, I got so far as to see we would make platforms, but we were still in the people are going to want to edit their templates and change the design, and you know, as opposed to a billion people all getting a blue and white page from Facebook.
Perfectly happy with it.
Yeah, which is we had some wrong assumptions culturally.
Right. No, I remember, and I worked on the Blogger redesign.
Yeah,
with Doug Bowman and a bunch of people, and people would, you know, go in and like mess up Doug Bowman's perfect template because, but. Because
nobody could do what he did.
But yes, which was like remove things until it was perfect. That was the best. The Minima thing was the best web template ever. Not only for its time, but just ever. Doug Bowman's thing, because he'd actually done what designers were supposed to do, removed everything inessential. So it was really, you know, the type was tiny by today's standards. And, you know, there are other things that you wouldn't do today, but he absolutely saw how you were supposed to make content readable and engaging.
Those templates you and Doug and Dan Cederholm and other folks made now 10 years ago, you still see those on blogs. You still talk
around.
Domini.
Yeah.
And boy, do they hold up. You know, there's a substance to them. But no, I mean, compared to what came look at the difference between just a short time before of a GeoCities page, which people still mock, or a tripod page, which people still use as the definition of crazy, undisciplined, incoherent design.
And look at MySpace. I mean, one reason MySpace lost to Facebook in a way was that people didn't want all that ugly customization. Most people prefer just something simple and clean to use.
Right. So this actually relates to the other point. The digression I was on of you know, I thought institutions were going to decide how society went. I came back to New York and said, I want to change institutions. And I knew that at that level of detail, okay, I know the patterns by which design rises and falls on the web and how it just sort of influences adoption and things like that. But I had no idea about, well, are there similar patterns in what decides which legislation gets adopted, right? Are there, you know, we have code smell and design smell, and we can look at a page and know, oh, I know which CMS generated that, mm-hmm. you know, all the way down to the tech by looking at it mm-hmm. as web experts. And can someone in the transportation committee in the House look at a bill and say, I know exactly which lobbying group generated this legislation by the phrasing they're using about how they talk about...
I know who Kevin Spacey killed, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the House of Cards thing is really interesting to me because it's sort of, it's wonderful and terrible. I mean, besides the right. obvious corruption and the drama of the whole thing.
It's an exaggerated vision of what actually does happen.
Sure. And that these things are all negotiations. The concept that's always in my head and that came when I came back to New York and started looking at institutions, the thing that kept popping up was imagine the meeting. Every single thing, and I think designers know this better than anybody in the world, you walk down the street and you see a sign at a fast food restaurant and you can see and you can picture the dialogue of the entire meeting where it was designed.
When I used to be in advertising, and early in my career, we'd laugh at like really bad advertising. We'd say, look at these hacks and how could these... Yeah. And after a while, I realized, no, they probably were very talented people who had a really great idea and the client killed that. And at a certain point, or if not the client, their boss, or the account director wanted a good meeting. And after three failed attempts to sell a client something dangerous that would have actually helped them, the account supervisor said, no, we're going to sell them the safe thing that they want. And we'll charge up the hill another year, boys.
And that was the thing of understanding that all of design, architecture, all the institutions around us are artifacts of that process, yes. of that negotiation, of the compromise, of the give and take, of somebody being worn down after 3 hours in a meeting and saying, fine, the hell with it, here, take it.
And yet somehow, sometimes you get a flat iron building.
Yes, this is the perfect example because I look at there was a building near Times Square that this was really instructive to me. The building in plan on top view was not square. It was nearly square, but it had this series of stair-step setbacks on the northeast corner. And at first I thought, try to think through it logically, oh, this must be about making sure daylight passes to another building or there's some zoning requirement, whatever. Long story, slightly less long. It turns out that it was built by a corporation that where people valued corner offices. And by having two stair-step cutback on each floor, you could have six corner offices per floor instead of four. Mm. And so they were able to sort of soothe the ego of two more people per floor. Brilliant. And that had enough institutional value to add who even knows how much cost. To the construction of this building. And that understanding of everything. And then I sort of think, well, what story is the Woolworth building telling me? What story is the Flatiron building telling me? What story is the Empire State Building?
Woolworth, there was one client, he paid for it in cash. The joke was that he paid for it in pennies because Woolworth at the time, it was a five and dime store. At the time it was built, people paid pennies for things. Pennies had meaning. I think now there's a science fiction reason for pennies continuing to exist. But back then, people could buy things with pennies, and so the joke was that he'd commissioned this building and paid for it. He definitely did pay for it in cash, not in pennies, and there was one architect and one client, and they basically, I guess, were impressed with each other and sat down and said, yes, but I don't know. To me, the Woolworth building is, it's a Mozart.
Yeah.
But who knows?
But this is that rare thing, right? So that at least is an artifact of somebody was empowered enough to take it and run with it and create this sort of singular work of art.
Right.
But in every case, what our physical architecture is, what our legal infrastructure is, what the technology we use on our screens, all these things are these artifacts of these human, frail, fraught processes, these fragile little things that sort of fit together. And that was like the great joy where I was like, well, then if I know how to hack tech,
meetings, right?
Then and we have view source on all of our laws, and we have to an approximation view source on the way films are made, right? I've always been that person that loves DVD extras more than the film most of the time. And
I miss that with streaming.
That's I do
the
too.
Only thing I miss too. With streaming.
I do too. Yeah. And even to some degree, you know, a lot of the artists I like are posting a Pro Tools session online and things like that. Like that sort of sense of this is all hackable and knowable and we can see the way it fits together, that sort of redefined what I saw as important to my life's work, where before I just wanted to make a good app.
Now, how did you know that you could start a company instead of going, okay, with what I know, I'm a pretty good catch. Why don't I go to the New York Times, or why don't I go to Foursquare? They seem like a smart company, but having some difficulties. And this was what? 1990? No, this was 2007.
Yeah.
And maybe it was too soon for Foursquare, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
How did you know to start your own business?
I don't think I've ever discussed this publicly, but I talked to the Twitter guys. I think both sides were sort of, moderately interested. And I was like, you're going to have a New York office and we should do this thing. And what I realized was, one, they didn't need me. Like, they were going to be fine. You get a murderer's row like Ev Williams and Biz Stone and Jason Goldman and all down the line. And it's like they didn't have any use for me, that they wasn't something they could do on their own. The other part for me was like I had spent a lot of time at Six Apart, and the founders were are incredible people. And one of the lessons I took away was that there I had social authority because people knew I was friends with the founders and had been around a long time, but no sort of positional authority. I was always this sort of very externally facing person, and so
I thought you were like not technically the third founder, but you sort of. I thought of them as two super shy geniuses who got another super smart person who was less shy to be their mouthpiece. That was my perception.
I think in the first year that I was there, that was probably true. I think pretty quickly, there was sort of professional business manager types, which I had never really been.
Right.
And so I think I had a very idealistic belief in the community and try to do right by them and everything will work out okay. And I think it actually – one of the things I learned is any institution has to have that sort of baked into its business model and into intrinsically the way that it's run. That's a fundamental reason that it ended up so disconnected from what people wanted and whether it was movable type or the other things they did sort of never really landed was there was not a baseline connection enough to the community where I was spending all my time talking to them, but I couldn't filter that back into – not just the products, but the process and the sort of the values of the company.
And you felt like if I stay inside, if I go to another company, I'll have the same problem. I'll be really good with the community, but I won't be able to meld what I'm learning about the community.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if I become a consultant, then I will.
Well, yes and no, right? So some of it was I wanted to learn how the big institutions work. I would never presume that they were going to just do by fiat what I said, but at least there was an understanding of what the relationship was. What did I have authority over? The joke I had always made was like, I couldn't take a job at a tech startup that already existed because you can never be promoted to founder. And what I needed was sort of some definition of authority. And the interesting thing about consulting, it was never like, that's what I want to be when I grow up.
Not for anybody.
But there was a really clear definition of they wanted to solve a particular problem. And then having access to do that, I think one of the sort of most fascinating examples of that to me that would not have happened any other way was my co-founder, Michael Wolff, had been, he'd been president of MTV and done all these other things. And he was just sort of showing me, these different companies. This is how it works. This is how you talk to the CEO. And this is how to sort of solve the problems in the context.
Were you guys just like meeting for drinks and it turned into, hey, let's start a business together?
Yeah. We'd been introduced. We crossed paths a number of times. And I'd always been like, it was interesting to me because it was like, this is this guy who had been at the pinnacle of media and had been at McKinsey and the sort of pinnacle of consulting and was spending his time around startups. And I was like, very few of these guys would do that. And if they did, they would think they were slumming.
Right.
And so that
not
was,
anymore.
No, but this is, 5 years ago. And so that was pretty interesting.
Do you think his authority? So one of the things is businesses that are sort of entrenched want someone like you who's younger, who comes from outside to have an insight that they don't have, but they also want to feel they don't want a 20-year-old coming to them and saying, move to Williamsburg, dude. That was a terrible example, but you know what I mean?
A flawless example.
Okay. So So they need that person that's coming in is younger and outside to also have some insiderness and some authority. It's like, you know, it's the usual thing clients want. I want something no one's ever done before, and I want three examples of how it's worked in the past.
Yes.
So you had to be the young outs. So do you think that by teaming with Michael Wolff, you were able to present a sort of, we have authority, we have gravitas, we have seniority, we know how this stuff really works from the inside, but we also have that outsiderness. Do you think that's why?
Very much so.
That seems like an ideal team in a way.
Yeah. And I think that was, and it was also very sincere, right? I mean, I think there's a calculated way of like, well, we need one of these and one of those, and maybe we can lash them together and they'll work.
No, I think you liked each other for that reason.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a real, and there was just, for me, it was just, it's just been a great learning experience. You know, I think there's a sort of, I respect institutions a lot for a guy who sort of identifies as a radical, where, you know, people are always like, oh, these big dumb companies don't get it. And it's the same as saying, why does that company, why is that ad so ugly? Right?
Yeah.
You're like, no, there's actually a lot of good reasons. And even when people say government doesn't work, until fairly recently, and this is only a minor change, I actually think our federal government works pretty well. And I'm probably the only person I know that feels that way. But if you understand the design constraints under which it was built and what it's supposed to do, it actually works pretty well. You can go on Wikipedia.
It's supposed to enable slow progress.
Yeah.
And prevent fascism and other kinds of totalitarianism from erupting. Mm-hmm. Even if someone's really popular.
And prevent wild whipsawing, right? Like the thing, like what builds trust in any context is predictability to some large degree. And
so it can't really go too far right or too far left. It can't be. Yeah. I know what
you're saying. So in that case, again, if you look at this from
the constraints are working.
Yes. Yeah. The boundaries are working.
But it makes it kind of like Microsoft. The reason people lose passion is because the government can't be some amazing new software company that comes from out of nowhere like Twitter and changes what you do. It's not going to ever be that. It can't be that. It can't be started in a garage. The government is not. It might have been started in a garage, but that was 200 years ago.
Right. And if nobody ever got fired for buying Microsoft or for buying IBM, nobody ever got fired for kind of believing in the United States. You know, that's sort of the last century is that story. Now, can you preserve that? Maybe.
There's so much more we can talk about, and you've just taken us to a wonderful inflection point. So I'm gonna break, accounting that the listener will stay. I'm gonna break and do a quick sponsorship thing. It'll take about 5-10 seconds. Today's show is presented, as mentioned earlier. Today's show is presented by An Event Apart, the design conference for people who make websites. An Event Apart is an intensely educational 2-day learning session for passionate practitioners of standards-based web design. If you care about code as well as content, usability as well as design, An Event Apart is the conference for you. Visit aneventapart.com to register for a 2-day conference, a 1-day workshop, or save when you sign up for all 3 days. And Big Web Show listeners save $100 off any 2 or 3 day Event Apart event in 2014 when you register using discount code AEABWS. That's AEABWS for An Event Apart Big Web Show. Okay. You're involved in so much stuff now. And I guess part of you've done some government work, haven't you? Or you've done some advising?
Kind of around it. So,
around elections? What was it around exactly?
What had happened about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I'd started a project called Expert Labs. And it was backed by the MacArthur Foundation and by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is the folks that published.
Just stop a second. You're like 30 when you did this?
35.
How did you do this?
So this is a fascinating thing. I came at it from the tech standpoint, which was I got this far. I don't want to work in the conventional tech industry anymore. I have a little bit of technical skill. I kind of know how to build communities, and I know there's a potential to improve how government works. That was literally it. And I talked to Joey Ito, who is an undersung hero of the internet. And he introduced me to a bunch of folks that had just come into the then new Obama administration working on a variety of problems. Folks like Katie Stanton, who's now at Twitter, Andrew McLaughlin, who's now at BetaWorks.
Why are they all leaving?
Well, they did. They each spent years working under the administration.
So they worked there 4 or 5 years, and then they're just exhausted, like you do.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons. I mean, and you know, there are people, very good people, that went to work on very hard problems, moved the ball, you know, pretty far forward. But also keep in mind, you know, these are folks that you, you can do great work and arbitrarily, because of some news cycle, be subpoenaed by Congress for things, and you know, have your inbox published in the New York Times, or sure. You know, have your motives questioned. And I've seen it happen to a number of friends that have gone through this, and that sort of the politicization of what are actually fairly straightforward working jobs is a real shame. I don't know
how anyone. I felt actually since Bill Clinton was impeached.
Yeah.
I felt I just don't understand how anyone at any one level of government can do lawmaking, because they spend most of their time raising funds and the rest of the time deflecting charges by the other party, where someone comes along and goes, that's a, you know, and viewed in a certain light, this thing that you did doesn't look good. So let's have an investigation.
Well, and especially innovative people, because those are the things that are most likely to, one, either not immediately succeed, which DC calls failing, or two, be surprising, which DC calls failing. And then you can proudly go to the newspaper and say, this project failed, we wasted money, this is pork. That being said, keep in mind, there are a lot of people working for government, and a huge number of them doing really, really good work. So when you and I go to the coffee shop in our neighborhood and we get on Wi-Fi, we say, oh, that works because they have an airport, an Apple airport, and that's why the Wi-Fi works. Or they got service from, you know, Verizon or from Time Warner, and that's why the Wi-Fi works. But one of the fundamental reasons the Wi-Fi works is because there was a really good piece of FCC regulation. Its number was 802.11. It has since been amended.
That's sounding familiar.
Right? And it's been amended a bunch of times. You get to by the time you get to F, you're at 6, and you get to G, and that's eight, you know, 7 times the law has been amended. You go down all the way to N, and you think, okay, 14 times this law has been amended. And each time this regulation was updated, it moved the industry forward. It made connection speeds faster, and it meant that I didn't care whether the coffee shop I went to used a D-Link or a Apple router. It just worked.
Standardization.
Right. But enforced standardization, because we know that would not have happened had there not been good regulation.
But if the right people heard of it, they'd say that's tyranny.
Sure, but
I don't want to use the same spec as someone else. I've got a better spec.
Right. And what do we think about – what do we think the cost has been to Apple of having a Verizon version of the iPhone and an AT&T version of the iPhone, and that we can't port from one to the other because they're different hardware?
Right. It's crazy.
Right. So this – that is actually, when people talk about the bureaucrats and the red tape and all those monsters in the beltway, some poor person who probably worked at the FCC for 30 years, working on these policies, regardless of who was in charge of whatever administration was in place at the time, kept refining and improving those regulations. And it worked, and they enabled billions of dollars in value. They obviously didn't do it to get rich or famous, because I don't know who they are. And even if we did, we certainly wouldn't assume that their salary was more than maybe $65,000 a year.
Right.
And they had to deal with each of the companies they talked to saying, no, we've got a better way.
I will propose one way, though, in which the government process fails dreadfully, which is when the government wants to outsource design and development to a company.
Sure.
There's an RFP process. It's even worse than a normal RFP process. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things you have to sign up for to be a vendor in their system. And
yes.
The job, first of all, is going to go to the person who knows best how to navigate the process by which they hire, not the person with the best proposal.
Yes.
Not the person with the best designers and technologists. And then in that subgroup, they have to go almost always with the cheapest proposal.
Right.
And since everyone knows that, the people who are really good at gaming it don't actually put out an honest proposal and say, yes, it's going to cost $300,000. They say it's going to cost $100,000. And then they build in all these overage charges that they know they will be billing for. So the whole thing becomes dishonest.
Right. So I agree. I think it's procurement is one of the most corrupt areas and wasteful areas of government. So this problem you've outlined, I think actually people are very familiar with that.
Sure.
Right? I think if you ask an average person, they'll tell you about $800 hammers and $500 toilet seats and all the other famous government.
But this is the opposite. This is a $50,000 website that should have been a $300,000 mm-hmm. website. So it doesn't function properly. And then the overages to fix it end up being $1 million and everyone's right. upset.
So here's the thing that's interesting.
But the process was the cause.
This was part of what we looked at when we were doing this Expert Labs project. So we were this nonprofit project saying we want to make government tech work better broadly and then more specifically get public feedback to policymakers. And a number of things touched on this. So in one case it was when the FCC wanted to get feedback on the – if you remember the proposed merger of AT&T and T-Mobile several years ago. Mm-hmm. And the process typically at that point was – we're going to get feedback by, you can fax us or you can mail a letter to this address. And we said, well, the people that actually should be weighing in on this probably want to reply to your Facebook page or tweet a link to you. And there was no way to get that onto the record. So we spent a lot of time working on that issue. There's a technology piece, and I'll talk about that more, but gathering all those responses. There's how do you get them onto the record. At some points, we're like, I'll pay an intern to read the tweets out loud in a public hearing meeting, and that will get them onto the record.
Because
that's what it takes.
Because that's what it takes. Because a lot of the process, the process is based on what you could do in the 19th century.
Right, right. And to some degree, they also had reasonable requirements in the past era, which was okay. We have to have a physical address for everybody that wants something on the record, so that we know that they're actually Americans weighing in on this,
and that it's real people. And
right. And that's not unreasonable, no. Except when you're saying somebody tweeted at me, and you're saying, "Well, I don't know how to get that." Right, so there's a set of reasonable constraints. There are simply anachronistic or out of date constraints, and then there are things that are just silly to begin with.
It's but also that was, easy to get multiple Twitter accounts.
Right, so we started building. We as me and Gina Trapani started building this toolkit of let's at least gather these responses so we can do something with them. And Gina had built this to scratch her itch when she had been running Lifehacker, which she co-founded and was the founding editor of. And we started building this toolkit, and then you realize, okay, well, if the government agencies want to use this, how do we even make it available to them? And then we bumped into the exact problem you talked about of procurement. Well, how do they buy this? Even if we say we have the best social media monitoring tool or the best toolkit or the best software or whatever, we can't sell it to them because we're a nonprofit. We can't give it to them because, with good reason, you can't give gifts to government agencies. And so we started to kind of looking at all these different issues. And this was where
sell it to them for a dollar?
Well,
the way sweat equity works.
You know, there are a number of different ways to get there, and there ended up being a number of solutions to this. One part was there actually have been radical reforms to procurement for technology. There's a thing called RFPEZ, which made RFPs, request for proposals, easier in the same way the 1040EZ made the 1040 tax form easier. And it would let an average small design firm bid for a job without having to know the process and without it being corrupt. And so that they could actually at least put in an honest bid. Now, the issue of always choosing the lowest bid is a separate thing, but put aside the numbers for a bit. At least they could participate in the process, right? So that's something that's a huge leap forward, and that's starting to get some traction with a lot of government agencies at the federal level. The second part was they had a thing called apps.gov, which has now been folded under data.gov, the open data site for the federal government. And what it did is let a government agency pick from a whole bunch of common web apps, and all they had to do is check an additional box on the terms of service to make sure it was compliant with federal regulations. Some of the examples were before the current administration, the agencies that wanted to have a blog essentially couldn't use WordPress or Blogger or anything else because the terms of service of those services often said any dispute will be resolved by the laws of the state of Delaware. Now, federal law prohibits a government agency from being subject to the laws of the state of Delaware. So they couldn't check I agree on that box even if they wanted to. And all it took was a small additional block of text on the terms of service and say, by the way, if you're a federal agency, this is what's the actual prevailing law for a jurisdiction. And that seems like a little thing, but it took a little bit of time to teach that. And then they went app by app and they got Tumblr to agree to that. They got WordPress to agree to that. They got all these things down the road. And the net result of that was when a government agency now wants to launch a blog, they just go to WordPress.com or Tumblr and they launch a blog. So the State Department is on Tumblr. And the cost there, it literally, and I remember this because I used to sell blogging software, the cost for a single agency to have a blog that they developed from scratch that met all their security requirements prior to this administration averaged $1 million.
Yep. I came at it from bidding on projects for museums.
I bet.
Happy Cog and New York museums where we were saying, yeah, we could put you on Expression Engine.
Right.
And there's like a, you know, you're going to pay about $80 a year to renew your license as many seats as needed. And they were like, no, we're completely vested in this, paying for every seat, $1 million a year CMS with this technology that's probably not going to last another 5 years.
Right.
But strangely enough, the IT director was also not going to last another 5 years. That was a person who was about to retire.
Right.
And they wanted to protect the jobs of their buddies.
Again, it's an artifact of the institution and of the, right. the sort of ordinary humans in that meeting.
They were like, these guys have come up with me and I want to save their jobs and
take care of them.
Take care of them. I'm their dad.
And that's not evil, right?
No, it's not evil.
It's wasteful.
Protecting your employees is not evil, except that so then this museum that's partly funded by the city and partly funded by private donors has to keep raising tons of money it doesn't really need to spend.
Right. Or could spend elsewhere, at least.
Could spend elsewhere, like perhaps getting artifacts.
Right.
Or starting a children's program or doing educational outreach. There's a million things they could do.
And I think one of the hardest
improving things – improving their archiving.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the hardest things is to have empathy for institutions. I think by our nature, we're very empathetic to one another as individuals, especially face-to-face. We know that when the isms, the racism, sexism things happen, it's because we're distanced from a group that we haven't had enough personal interaction with.
I knew a guy who was a racist in the way he talked. He'd grown up on Long Island. But in his behavior toward individuals, you would never know. You couldn't even put those two things together.
Right. Right. And that's that sort of – it happens through proximity. It happens through familiarity. It happens because people are genuinely kind to one another and face-to-face. And the same thing happens with institutions. Right? So people will say government is corrupt and say, well, how do you feel about I have a good close friend who is an NIH researcher who works on cancer drugs for kids. And he was getting ready to shut down his lab during the government shutdown last year. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to people. I say, oh, they're a bunch of bureaucrats. They're wasting my tax dollars. I said, how do you feel about this guy who holds the hands of the parents whose kids have cancer and gives them the worst news of their life every single day? You know, that's the red tape guy you're talking about. That's the wasteful bureaucrat. And you put it on a personal level and say, well, that's one of the good guys. And say, okay, now that's a dramatic example. Let's take a less dramatic example. How do you feel about the policymaker who made it possible for you to get Wi-Fi at Starbucks? And then say, well, that one's okay too. And I can go down those. So how do you feel about the soldier? How do you feel? And you're actually very hard pressed to find more than a handful of people they do think are bad. Right? So there's hundreds of thousands of people working for the government. They say the government's corrupt. We certainly can point to corrupt politicians, whatever. But keep in mind, there's a couple hundred people in Congress, and there's a couple hundred thousand people working for government. And that is this thing where we need to be able to have institutional empathy to think, you know what? If a bunch of really smart, thoughtful, caring people built this institution together, even for all its flaws, maybe there's some reason it is the way it is.
So does Activate work with government agencies only with companies?
Only with companies. And this is the way I did. So I think with Expert Labs, it was, we're going to do this with institutions. And then as we were winding down Expert Labs, the technology took off and actually became ThinkUp, which I'll talk about in a minute.
I don't want to run out of time, so I would love to.
I'll do it now.
Let's get to ThinkUp. What is it?
ThinkUp, very succinctly, is an app that gives you statistics, analytics, and analysis about how you use your social networks. And the way I keep saying it is it's almost quantified selfies.
Okay. So it's like Fitbit only for my social media.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. The way I look at this is if you're a business, there's tons of great analytics tools, right? They'll tell you about your follower count and your conversion funnel or whatever those things are. What I cared about was Who did I make laugh this week? Who was really paying attention to what I said? Did I make anybody's day better? What is the meaning in all this time I'm spending online? Right. As a father, I think I,
because you're taking away time from your son.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had spent, my son was two when Gina and I really started doing this full time. And I thought, I've spent more time reading my Twitter timeline since he was born than I've spent reading to him. And that is not who I see myself as.
But is this, I can see this app being incredibly appealing to you and me, mm-hmm. and maybe 3,000 of the people who listen to this show.
Yep.
But I can't see it being a mass product, which I guess you're okay with.
All good. That is fine.
Okay.
I think we're so reflexively obsessed, especially in the tech industry, with scale.
Well, the startup scene over the past, I don't know, 5 years has just been about, a million dollars isn't cool. $1 billion is cool.
Yeah. And I'm very obsessed with community, and communities at scale.
It's small. It's community. Yeah. It's always smaller.
Yeah. And we've got under 2,000 paid members to ThinkUp right now, just from our crowdfunding campaign. And I literally wake up every day and I'm so proud and moved by the fact that people basically put a bet on us before we even had a product available for them to use, because I said, I think Gina and to some degree Anil are trustworthy enough that they're going to make something that's worthwhile to me.
How much money did you raise?
Our goal was to get 1,000 backers. And so ThinkUp is either $5 or $10 a month. So you pay either $60 or $120 for a year subscription. And the goal was to get 1,000 backers in a month when we launched the campaign back in October. And we got it in a week. And that was, it was terrifying actually when we launched it, because I have a lot of Twitter followers or whatever, or people know me from the blogosphere. But that doesn't cost anybody anything, and it's not really a commitment. And maybe there are people that hate follow me. They are like, I follow him because this guy annoys me, which I don't judge them for. That's fine. Sure. You have enough followers, weird things happen.
Right.
And so to some degree, you put something out there, and you're like, well, now we're actually asking, do you believe in what we're saying and what we're doing and what we think we can build? And what a leap that was. That was a little bit of like, I'm going to just trust fall, and I believe you are all going to catch me. And not only, did people catch us, but they really just said, this is the kind of company I want to have exist, separate from the product. Like, we'll make the product better. It's not, we're 1% of the way down the road.
The web page at thinkup.com has some nice looking examples, but currently you can't click into them to get more details.
No.
It's very much a promise list. It's a sort of a sketch.
It's very, yeah. And it is a bit opaque. And part of the reason why is just we've been in beta building it. What we did is we did the crowdfunding campaign, and then we gave it to those very early users in beta back in January, and then have been just sort of iterating ferociously since then. And the product's getting better and better. I feel like we're about a week or two away from it being ready for somebody who hasn't seen it or used it to come in and give it a try.
Are you going to do the video thing?
God, I don't know. We did a video for the crowdfunding thing, and I said, listen, no acoustic guitars, no no like hipsters in coffee shops.
You've always been like, I remember like 1 week, what was that? Oh God. This was the first big Korean pop hit to break in America, and it was immediately
parodied. Gangnam Style?
Yeah, and you were like, you put it really beautifully. It was like 2 weeks into that thing starting to get parodied, and you were like, that viral business card that you're going to have for Christmas, where you don't have to do that now.
Let it go. Yeah. I just think you look at something,
you see where it's going,
and you see, oh, this is the horrible, inevitable marketing thing that's going to come out of it. And even just, I mean, there are tons of good apps that have a great, plink plink acoustic guitar video behind them and some dude in a coffee shop holding the phone and just looking like this app changed his life and whatever. Like, that's all great. I'm glad this worked for people. They're certainly familiar.
But this is purely analytics, right? It's not going to be like TweetDeck, where I can or like TweetDeck that includes Facebook, or you know what I mean? There are some apps that you have where you can access your Flickr photos and your Instagram photos from the same social photo app. And
yeah, it's so not this like is not that. That.
You're not publishing.
I'll tell you what shows up in my ThinkUp stream. It's a simple stream. I look at it on my phone or on my desktop, and it'll tell me, hey, you know what? A verified user followed you, and this is her name, and this is really interesting. And last week you retweeted this person, and it brought what they said to 40,000 more readers than it would have had otherwise, and that was really cool.
You know, this is a true story.
Right when we first started building the current iteration of the product, a couple of the first things that Gina built, one of them was, who's your biggest fan on Facebook? And it told me, and this is because my son is super cute, nobody had liked more photos of mine on Facebook than my mother, and I called my mother. So like killer app number one for us is like you call your mom because she's your fan on Facebook. And sort of similarly, Gina built this thing that we had been talking about for ages, and she sort of knocked it out in one afternoon, and it was, how much have I mentioned myself, I, me, myself, we, in the past week? And you know, and Gina built it, and for her it was like 8 times, and she thought, oh, I should probably dial it back. That's a little self-absorbed. And for me, we ran it, it was like 125 times. And, you know, and instantly my behavior changed. And it wasn't judgmental. It wasn't like you're a bad person for this.
No.
It was just let's hold up a mirror to what you're doing. And then at least you can be thoughtful and think about it. So what do you want to be doing?
Again, it's like Fitbit in that, you know, when you first start wearing, I don't know, you wear Fitbit, I think. But
I have the Nike one, but it's the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, so and at first you're just keeping track of what you're actually doing. And then after a while, because of your competitive streak or because you want to be a better person or more fit or whatever, you start going, you know what, wow, I was, you know, I'm only at 9,500, but
yeah.
I'll just do some laundry and get up to the number that I want because, you know, if I just do a little more work. And so you end up, you know, walking just a little bit more and that kind of thing. And so this is like that.
Yeah. Literally every day in the office, we're like, this refrain comes up of a little bit better every day, a little bit better every day. And I'm not, you know, and it's that's been the thing that's been, I think, most profound to me is it made me think about this time I was spending and say, I could do something with this. I can be thoughtful about what I share, who I talk to, who I amplify, and make some meaning out of this. And this is what, you know, we were joking earlier about, like, I'm involved in all these things. It's actually part of what pushed me that way is to say, like, there is no glamour in saying I'm in the Aspen Institute's efforts around learning in the internet that's going to publish a report. But it made me say, you know what, I'm fortunate enough, privileged enough that some number of people read what I say. What do I want to talk to them about? What do I want to invest that time in? And one of those things was like, I care deeply about education, and I don't feel it has learned the lessons that I've seen from the technology industry about how change can come. And I am terrified of the public school and that in the neighborhood that both of our kids live in being disrupted by technology like the record store in our neighborhood was, and saying, okay, well, then I can contribute to that. And you know, that's not all directly attributable to ThinkUp, but certainly spending every day thinking about how do I get more time, value out of the time I spend online did inform that greatly.
People are going to use social media. Everyone, just about who can, will use social media in a way that pleases them. And some people, it's just fun and they're not going to think about it anymore. But for those who want to be thoughtful about it,
you have
this thing. So I just signed up to be notified when you have a spot for me.
Oh, awesome. Actually, you know what? We haven't launched publicly, but because you are such a valued part of our community for so long, what I wanted to do is actually give a sign-up address for people that are interested in it. You can go to thinkup.com/bigwebshow. And it's a subscription form. I apologize. It's like literally here's a place to pay us money. But it's for people that are interested and think that kind of idea is interesting. And you can sign up and use it now before it's available to the general public. And we really do want to hear your feedback. When you email our help form, I personally read it. You know, if you're a user, and one of the things we do is we email people every day about, you know, these are the things you did, and you know, here's somebody interesting that replied to you, or here was a list that you got added to, and does that sound like a good description of you? That sort of thing. And when you get that email from the app, if you literally reply to the notification from the app, it comes to my inbox.
Now it says, so I go to thinkup.com/bigwebshow. That's awesome. And one account per social network. What does that mean?
What that means is
five accounts per social network.
So it's whether you want to hook up one Twitter and Facebook account, and it'll hook up to both Twitter and Facebook today with other networks coming. And then, and that's the sort of one account level. And then if you have, you know, multiple ones, like you've got,
like I do.
Yeah. So you've got one for Lista Part and one for, you know, Zelman and whatever else, then you would go to the sort of multiple accounts.
Done. I have never paid a guest on this show before.
Wow. Well, that's
so.
Thank you very much.
Hopefully, we're doing that right now. Okay, I will finish when we get off because I don't want to take my mind away from what we're actually doing. But this has been super cool. I'm glad we did this. I really like the things we've been discussing, and I'd love to talk to you again in person. But I'd love to talk to you again on the show sometime because I think you have a lot of a unique perspective on a lot of important issues.
Thank you very much. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you for your time today. Anil Dash, ladies and gentlemen, and people who are interested can follow you at Anil Dash, right?
Exactly.
No underscore, and anildash.com? Dashes.com.
Yeah. Both will take you there.
Okay. Good enough. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.